Welcome to Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk. I'm Ryan Dobson, and our host is psychologist and author Dr. James Dobson. And we often start our programs by discussing the topic we're going to look at. But today, I think we should first jump in by introducing our guest, because he is a remarkable person. And Dad, I'm going to let you handle those duties.
Well, he's been a friend of mine for many years, Ryan, and I am so pleased that we can interview him today. He's Rabbi Daniel Lappin, and he is going to be joining us by phone. In fact, I think he is on the phone now. He's the president of the American Alliance of Jews and Christians, which he founded with a mutual friend of ours, Gary Bauer. That was back in the year 2002. Rabbi Lappin has his own radio and television shows, and he is truly a Renaissance man. He's an authority on a variety of topics that interest me, and he's written many books that I think our listeners would be interested in, including the one we're going to talk about today. First, let me introduce our guest to our audience, Rabbi Daniel Lappin. I'll begin by saying, Rabbi, you are a great friend to Shirley and me. The last time I was with you, I think, was at the National Day of Prayer, where you've been a participant. And how nice of you to join us on the program today.
Well, it's absolutely wonderful. My only regret is that I don't see enough of you and Mrs. Dobson. And I cherish the opportunities that do come our way.
Well, we can do it by phone, and that's what we're doing today. Hey, you are called America's Rabbi. How did you get that title?
Well, first of all, I certainly never called myself that. I'll tell you that. I want neither the honor nor the responsibility. You know, I guess that whilst there are hundreds, if not thousands, of rabbis distributed throughout the Jewish community in America, I'm probably the one best known for interacting outside of the Jewish community. And I began calling for friendship with Christians many, many years ago. And I did that in the light of one of the teachers of my teacher. This is a teacher who died soon after World War II. I never met him. But my teacher told me that what he said is, they said, the day is going to come where there will be more anti-Christianism among Jews than there ever is anti-Semitism among Christians. And at that time, it'll fall to the duty of one rabbi to take on the task of turning around the viewpoint of the Jewish community to recognize who God has made their best friends at this moment on the radar screen of history. And I took that very, very seriously and began on that 20, 25 years ago, and we met very soon after that.
Well, that is how we became friends, because you became a friend to conservative Christians particularly, and defended the things that we believe, and there was just an instant bond between us. You're Jewish, and I'm Christian, and we have different theological views, but I love you like a brother and have for many years. And you've been really a defender of traditional, I would call them conservative Christian views ever since.
And well, I mean, I believe that America is the land that Christianity built.
Mm-hmm. Wow. The book we want to discuss today is your book. It's called Buried Treasure, Secrets for Living from the Lord's Language. There's a lot there to think about. First, talk about the Torah.
Sure.
Christians know it as the Pentateuch.
Right, exactly.
And how are they different?
Well, the Torah is the structure that provided data to human beings on how to structure society. And as a result, not surprisingly, those cultures that followed the advice of the Torah thrived and became a magnet for people all over the world, as we see to the present day. And there's so much vitality in any culture created by the scripture, by the Torah, that even with the abuse that it has been handed by decades of secular ascendancy. Nonetheless, these cultures are still far superior to anything else. This is a little bit like barbarians sacking a city and destroying the city and then living in the ruins, because those ruins are still better than anything they can come up with by themselves. And that's in a way what's happened here, where secularism is effectively in the process of shattering the structures of civilization, particularly family, and it still squats in the ruins of what's left because it's still superior to anywhere else.
Once again, let me bring you back to the Torah. Why is it revered in the Jewish community? First of all, it was written by Moses under the inspiration of Jehovah himself. Tell us a little more about it.
Well, we actually believe that it wasn't just inspiration, but it was actually dictated. And so
I believe that too.
We pay great attention to every word and every letter. We pay very great attention to specific reasons that the same word might be spelled slightly differently in two different places, recognizing a message that is being conveyed that way. We pay very much attention to where an account that appears twice but differently. For instance, if I was writing a book about Abraham sending his servant to find a bride for his son Isaac, then I would have Abraham, in my book, I'd have Abraham say to the servant, don't take a wife for my son from among the pagans over here. Go back to my family and find a wife for my son from there. And then I'd have the servant traveling to the family. He comes to the family, and it should say, in my version, it would say, the servant told the family everything that his master Abraham had told him. But instead of which, in Genesis, it actually retells the whole story all over again, excepting with some very crucial distinctions. The same thing happens, of course, when Pharaoh dreams his bizarre dreams. And we all know about the dream as it's recounted. And then he pulls Joseph out of the dungeon and he says, I hear you know how to do dreams. And he tells the dream all over again, which is just boring for a reader. No writer today would do that. The writer would say, and Pharaoh told Joseph his dreams, because the reader already knows the dreams. But no, this is the word of God, and there is a lesson to be learned in each and every one of these. And many of these lessons pertain specifically to how to be a husband, how to be a wife, how to be a parent, how to be a sibling, and how to be a child.
Mm. The words of the Torah have great meaning, don't they?
They are
today essentially what they were 2,000 to 3,000 years ago.
Yes, they are the same words, and we call it the Lord's language. Hebrew is the Lord's language. For one thing, it obviously is the language in which God dictated the Torah to Moses. For another, it's the only language actually not created by human beings, and it behaves in extremely amazing ways. One of the rules in the Lord's language is that if a word does not exist for a certain eternal concept, that concept doesn't exist. It's not a real concept. So what I've just said is not true for technology. For instance, Hebrew doesn't have a word for telephone. And so the Israelis came up with a beautiful Hebrew word for a telephone, which is telephone. And helicopter is, you know, not surprisingly, helicopter. But words like adolescent, there's no word in Hebrew for an adolescent. That's very significant. It's a bad concept. And so if you are somebody raising children and they hit those dread years of adolescence, you can take a very valuable lesson from the fact that that the Torah does not acknowledge the status of adolescent. You are a child or an adult. The problem with the word adolescent is that it is an attempt to make a grab for the privileges of adulthood while clinging to the privileges of childhood. And so the Torah says, as a parent, don't acknowledge the existence of adolescence in your house. You can say to your children, you know, you have the right. At any point you like, you can tell me when you want to stop being a child and be an adult. Here are the characteristics of an adult. When you are able to be an adult, I'll accept you as an adult. Until that time, you're a child. There isn't an in-between status.
Yeah.
So, you know, that would be an example. There are many other crucial words like retirement, for instance. And I know, Dr. Dobson, that you're certainly not thinking along these lines at all, and neither am I. But
believe me, I wouldn't be sitting here doing what I'm doing today if I didn't reach that conclusion.
Yeah, exactly. And so there's no word in Hebrew for retirement. Again, we do not find anywhere in the Torah this idea of, guess what, when you reach the age of 55, time for you to quit and go and play the primeval equivalent of golf. No, nothing like that at all. You have to stay engaged in serving God's other children through your work.
So, what you just described about adolescence would be understood in terms of bar mitzvah, right? That would be a time in the Jewish community where that transformation from childhood to adulthood suddenly occurs.
That's right. Now, today, we've obviously turned bar mitzvah into a mockery. It's now a party,
right,
with a life-size effigy of the bar mitzvah boy carved out of chopped liver. So it's a disaster. But in concept, what the Torah says is, look, God created man and woman different from one another. He created women with the ability to instantly and automatically transform themselves from little girls into young ladies. That just happens automatically. It just does. I mean, it's the most remarkable thing. But with six daughters, you know, I've seen it happen six times. You know, they're 2 or 3 year old, you know, grubby little infants, and then all of a sudden, even at the very young age of 4 and 5 and 6, they start becoming young ladies. And they look at their brothers who are rolling in the mud and picking their noses and pushing each other's heads underwater with complete bewilderment and astonishment. There's a very big difference. And that's why we find today, you know, 40-year-old adolescents. We find 40-year-old males, mm-hmm, who just haven't got their lives together. It is much less common to find women who don't get their lives together.
You know, Rabbi, starts earlier than that. Yesterday, Shirley and I were pleased to keep our grandkids. Lincoln is 7 years old, and Lucy is not quite 2. And yet, Lucy has a toy stroller and a doll, and there she is, you know, at 21, 22 months of age, pushing along this baby in a stroller. Mm-hmm. I mean, she's way above her years, way beyond her years.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And boys don't understand adult male responsibilities at all.
No, give a boy a doll, he'll break off its leg and use it as a revolver.
Oh, yeah, definitely. Lincoln's not playing that he has a job to bring home money to take care of the kids that he'll someday have.
he's not planning that.
Yeah, he's not doing that. But Lucy's definitely pushing a stroller. Yeah.
My daughters, when they were 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, I mean, before they were teenagers, my house was so littered with bride magazines, I was in danger of slipping and breaking my leg on any day. You know, boys are not looking and thinking to themselves, this is what I'd like my wedding to look like.
Hardly.
No, absolutely not.
So now, bar mitzvahs, what's that got to do with the Torah? Is that
the concept of bar mitzvah is in
the Torah?
Sure it is, in the sense that there are many, many, many rules and regulations built around males, far fewer around females, because females automatically, and this is one of the secrets of ancient Jewish wisdom, that women will automatically, given half a chance, become attached to the realities of life and understand God, understand spirituality, understand their roles as wives and mothers in a way that boys will never do by themselves. And so there are many, many, many more rules structured for boys than there are for girls. We're not the only culture this way. I mean, if you look at both Muslim tribes, you look at African tribes that have initiation rites, always for men, always for boys, almost never for girls, because they all recognize it's not needed. In other words, for any successful culture to endure, it has to find a way to masculinize and civilize and acculturate young males. And that the Torah is very big on.
Rabbi, as I was going through your book, you've got secrets hidden in the Hebrew language where
yes.
I think it's child and there's the word hand and
that's
instruct.
Quite right. Yes, that's quite right. That would be as if in English, let's imagine the word child, C-H-I-L-D. Well, let's imagine I-L meant instruct or teach or educate, and C-H and D meant hand. Well, in Hebrew, the word for child is built exactly like that. It's a word that's made up of the word educate, teach, or instruct, your hand. And so we learn that it's not only acceptable, but it's desirable to raise your children to see themselves as your extended arm. And so it's a wonderful thing when your child can join your work and become part of your ministry or part of your business. This is one of the reasons that in small towns across America, on the high street or the main street, you would very often see shop signs that said Smith and Son. You almost never saw things that said Jones and Daughter.
Sure.
It's almost always understood and recognized that your daughter becomes part of another man's family, and your sons go ahead and become, if you like, your extended arm. They're educated and trained in your ways. They further your belief system. They walk with God as you did. And so consequently, they really are your child. And they can then operate autonomously because while they are your extended arm, at the same time, they are also educated and directed and able to know what to do.
So your point is that that's not just a cultural phenomenon, that it is rooted in the Word of God.
Sure. And how many times have you, and I know I have, encountered clueless parents who, when confronted with their young children's waywardness, respond by saying, I don't want to direct their life. They have to find their own way in life. And so,
give us some other examples of Hebrew words that have deeper meaning.
Well, one of them that I'm very fond of is the Hebrew word for love. And the Hebrew word for love is built and based on the root word underneath it of the word for obligation. I tell a story in the book about somebody who began studying Bible with me a number of years ago. Turned out his wife developed polio just a few months after they were married. And so as a young married man, he found himself married to a woman who had to spend a large part of her day in an iron lung, as it was called back in those days. She was paralyzed. And his family came to him and they said to him, look, you know, you've been married less than a year. It's a tragedy that your wife contracted polio. One life is tremendously damaged that way. But why should it be two lives? You know, you have an obligation. She is your wife. Have her moved to a care facility. You are financially resourceful. Set up a trust fund that'll pay for it. And divorce her. And that way, you know, you're a young man. I mean, you're in your early 20s. You've just been married less than a year. Do the right thing and then get on with your life. And he said to me, he said, I got this advice from the people who loved me most, my friends and my family. He said, I even had a religious figure in my life who told me this was okay. He said, I didn't get that. He said, I married for better or for worse in sickness and in health. He said, and so this was sickness. I don't see that this changes the rules at all. And I said, well, I'm truly amazed. He said, don't you understand? I said, no, I totally understand. I'm amazed, but you are absolutely right.
Yeah.
And we became very, very close. And of course, I was at his home often. I met his wife. He had his car engineered to be able to carry her, and he carried her into the car, and they went to places. They were at our home very often. On one occasion, she called me in hysterical tears. And I went dashing over to their house, and he met me at the door, and he said, "This is the worst crisis our marriage has ever been in." By this time, they'd been married for 20 years. And I went in, and I said to her, "What's the matter?" She's crying and weeping and almost uncontrollably. She says, "He doesn't love me." And he says, "I never said that." So I said to her, "So tell me, what exactly happened?" She said, "I said to my husband, 'Why do you take such good care of me?' And he answered, 'Because it's my obligation to do so.'" Mm. And I wanted to hear that he loved me. So I said to her, "He does love you. That's irrespective. Of course he loves you. But tell me what your worst fear is. What is your biggest nightmare?" She said, "My biggest nightmare is he's going to get tired of my whining and my impossible ways. He's going to move me to a hospital and never see me again." I said, "Well, if his care for you was predicated on his feelings, on his love for you, then indeed you should wake up every morning in terror that he doesn't love you today. And since what he does for you, and since the care he takes over you is based on his love for you, when the love goes away, it's only right that he should stop caring for you and put you in a home. But since he's already told you that he takes care of you because of an obligation, one of the wonderful things about obligations is they don't vanish with feelings. You should be the most grateful, happy woman in the whole world." He didn't say he doesn't love you. He just said he's taking care of you out of a sense of obligation. That is a good thing, not a bad thing. And the extension of that is that, and I've told this to not only my own daughters, I've told it to other young women all the time. If you are willing to marry a man because he tells you he loves you, then I'm afraid you must be equally willing to let him go on the day he tells you that he loves his secretary at work more. If the marriage is based on love, then you have nothing to complain about when he stops loving you and loves somebody else. But if the marriage is based on covenant and commitment and promise and dedication and obligation, that never changes.
You know, it's really interesting that you tell that story, because early on in my broadcasting career, I interviewed a couple that had been through almost exactly what you described. And on this occasion, they were married and went on the honeymoon, and the wife was stricken with polio, infantile paralysis, on the honeymoon. And they came home. They had not even started life together, and he had to decide what he was going to do about that. And I came across them and interviewed them on my program about 40 years later. And all that time, he had fed her and dressed her and got her in bed at night and showered her and taken care of her and earned a living for her. She couldn't move at all, and yet he loved her. Now, I call that love. You call it an obligation. I think there's a lot of love involved there,
too. No, it's love as well. And the link is the Hebrew word. In the Lord's language, the word for love incorporates that word for obligation as well.
Does it also incorporate sacrifice?
No, because an obligation is an obligation regardless of what it costs. But what it does also incorporate is the word friendship. So friendship, love, and obligation are all linked in that fashion. And, you know, people used to say, as a result of a silly movie from decades ago, people used to say, love means never having to say you're sorry. Well, it's complete rubbish. I mean, never having to say you're sorry means there was no obligation in the first place. If there was an obligation and you betrayed it, of course you have to say sorry. And so this lesson from the Lord's language, that friendship, love, and obligation share a common word, makes a mockery of that notion that, love means never having to say you're sorry. Love is the height of obligation. Friendship is the height of obligation. One of the reasons that we feel comfortable in friendships is because we know our friends feel obliged to help us if we need them, just the way we feel obliged to help them.
Mm-hmm. Oh, Rabbi, that is an amazing piece on friendship and love. We have to cut in here because we're out of time, but we'll continue this conversation tomorrow. So if you'd like more information about Rabbi Lappin's book, Buried Treasure, or the Ministry of Family Talk, you can call us at 877-732-6825 or visit our website, drjamesdobson.org. And when you contact us, consider making a donation to help us maximize the matching grant that we currently have in play right now. Recently, we received a generous match to further the ministry of Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk, which means that every dollar you commit to us this month immediately doubles, increasing our ability to touch the lives of more people. So would you give today? You can donate online on our website at drjamesdobson.org, through Facebook, our smartphone app, or by calling us at 877-732-6825. Thanks for joining us today, and we'll see you again next time as we continue talking with Rabbi Lappin on the next edition of Dr. James Dobson's Family Talk.
Family Talk is not affiliated with Focus on the Family.